mind than chit-chat. It wasn't until we'd cut east, away from the water, that I started thinking how little I actually had in common with my friend. We were the same age, true, and lived near each other and went to the same school and church. But past that, our similarities ran thin. Once upon a time, 2 minutes in a baseball had been enough to hold us together for days on end. And now even fishing hooks couldn't do the job. And it occurred to me, too, that I'd started looking forward to Ruby's visits more than I missed the old days with Cleet. Finally, somewhere around the time I started blinking back soot from the Frisco rail yard, Cleet stopped in front of a livery stable. "This is it," he said. And I near asked him if his girl was a filly or a mare. But I thought better of it and followed him inside past a greasy-headed attendant who barely nodded our way and up a narrow flight of steps. A woman met us at the top, saying, "I didn't expect to see you back so soon, Cletus." And then we were in a parlor of sorts, though it was a stretch and a kindness to call it such. The stripped-down wood floor was full of splinters. Two gaudy velvet couches faced each other from opposite walls. A floor lamp threw just enough light to show that the woman had red hair and one too many buttons open on her dress. There was a strong air of wariness about her, as if she'd seen enough of the world to know it couldn't be trusted. Cleet went bashful, asking if Eunice was in. The woman said she surely was, though she was just having her bath, and might the two of us be interested in spending some time with Viola instead. Cleet's face went all kinds of red, especially after a hard-looking woman in a slip and garters stepped out from one of the adjoining doorways and cocked a hip at us. Then the red-haired woman raised her eyebrows at Cleet, asking, and Cleet sputtered how we'd prefer to wait for Eunice and Imogene, to which the slip and garters woman shrugged and disappeared back where she'd come from. And the boss lady, who I figured was the sportin' sort fellas whispered and passed notes about in school, said Imogene was out for a ride on her gray. "But Eunice will see you both for $3 apiece," she said. "One at a time, of course, this being a proper establishment." Then she paused a moment and added, "Unless you'd like to reconsider Viola." Well, Cleet Sears just about started to smoke, so I jumped in quick and said how I wasn't looking for company and was only there on account of my friend. And that seemed to settle Cleet enough for him to ask the madam if she minded me waiting with him. She said she didn't normally stand for dawdlers, but since Cleet was such a good customer, she'd let it slide that once. "He stays out here, though," she added, aiming a look like darts at me. "Or it's $1.50 extra." She even made me blush. Then she nodded, sealing the deal, and vanished behind a door of her own. After that, Cleet and me sat in the kind of silence that arises when two people have things to say to one another and can't figure out where to start. For my part, I wanted to know if it was true he'd started running with the clan. But when he scuffed his feet against the floor and started talking, it turned out he had something altogether more mercenary on his mind. "Imogene was supposed to be here," he mumbled. I replied it was fine she wasn't, since I was too covered in sweat and stink to be fit for romance. Cleet shrugged, not pointing out that he was in the same state himself. But he did clear his throat so long and hard that I wondered if there was something stuck in it. And he scuffed his feet again and asked if he could borrow $3. That's when I understood the real reason Cleet had invited me along. He was short on funds. To him, I was nothing but a piggy bank. Full up and ready for the hammer. I fished my wallet out of my pocket anyway and handed over the money. Cleet was just palming the bills when a damp-haired girl with painted-on eyebrows came out the same door the madam had gone into. Even in the poor light, her eyes caught the exchange. She hit it quick, though. It smiled so bright that I understood how Cleet could convince himself she loved him. Then me and Cleet stood up, and Cleet introduced us. I shook Eunice's hand and said it was a pleasure to make her acquaintance. She did likewise, and Cleet took her arm and dragged her away so that she barely had time to wink goodbye at me over her shoulder. Once they were gone, I flew out of that place fast as I could, down the stairs, past the stable attendant and seedy hotels and gambling parlors and opium dens that barely bothered pretending to be anything different. I figured I'd best get off the streets before someone recognized me. So I hoofed it quick to the Royal Theater and bought popcorn and licorice whips from a sidewalk vendor. Inside, Betty Blythe was breaking hearts on the big screen as the Queen of Sheba. I watched her, grateful for the cool dark of the place, until it was time to get to work. I sold records that afternoon, 6 of them. And after closing, Pop and me took the Model T out to an empty lot on the edge of town, and he gave me a driving lesson just like he'd promised to do once my cast was off. I made a hash of coordinating all her pedals and levers at first, but towards the end, I got better. Enough so that Pop promised to let me try navigating a real road next time. Still, come bedtime, steering wheels and chassis were the last things on my mind. I lay there thinking how Cleet wasn't really a friend anymore, and how close-knit and complicated the world really was. What with some folks being good and some being bad, and most sitting in the middle with room to slide either way. I thought about Clarence and what I'd done to him. About Joseph and how I'd come to know him through Ruby's stories. I thought about Ruby, too. For I truly did care about her, pest and bother though she was. Put together, it all added up to a revelation of sorts. Big enough to bust through my thick skull, sharp enough to stay there. And maybe all that pondering I did on the things that had happened since the 2 knock would have been enough to make a righteous man out of me after all. But in the end, I never did have a chance to find out.
Rowan. The fact that Geneva thought she could tell a body had been brown-skinned from its bare skull messed with my head. My first reaction was to assume she was full of shit. I mean, how could you possibly tell skin color from bones? Then I remembered the glob of hair I'd pulled off the skeleton and figured maybe there had still been some skin on it. But when I asked, Geneva assured me that the matted gnarl had been pure, unadulterated, flesh-free human hair. "I know he was black from his skull," she said. My internal "you're a racist" radar pinged like crazy, and I started hating her just a little bit. She didn't seem to notice. Then again, when it came to the living, Geneva didn't notice much. "Skull morphology is influenced by the environment a population evolves in," she said. "I can evaluate discrete skull characteristics and match them up with typical profiles for geographically distinct human groups. Translation, black people's skulls are different from white people's skulls." And she didn't stop explaining there. "For example, eye orbits tend to be sloped in people with European ancestry, rounded in American Indian descendants, and rectangular in groups from sub-Saharan Africa." Ping! "And nasal openings evolved high and narrow in Europeans, heart-shaped at the base in Native Americans, and wider in dark-skinned Africans." Ping, ping, ping. But even though what Geneva said had rubbed me wrong in all kinds of ways, I hadn't had any trouble accepting what creaky old Mrs. Manos taught us in 9th grade bio. That the closer your ancestors lived to the equator, the more likely you were to have dark skin. Melanin protects you from ultraviolet radiation. More UV at the equator, more melanin. It was evolution. It made sense. So why was it hard to accept that there might be other differences? Ones that ran deeper than skin. I've got some ideas about that now, but when I walked out of the back house that afternoon, all I knew was that I felt dirty. And since Mom keeps the thermostat pegged at 67 so she can wear sweaters all summer, a long, hot shower in our house feels good even if it's 100 degrees outside. My shower, by the way, has 4 spray nozzles and an overhead rainfall faucet and is amazing. I stood underneath it a long, long time, steaming away the tension in my shoulders, washing my hair slowly. I rubbed shampoo over the bumps and ridges of my skull, wondering what it would look like after I died and all the skin and fat and muscle were gone. I traced the bones of my face, the ridges at the tops of my eye sockets, my cheekbones, my jaw. Water cascaded over the brown of my hands, the pinks of my nails, splashing onto the white shower tiles at my feet. If Geneva had my skeleton on a slab in front of her, what would she see? The white ancestors on Dad's side, who'd left Germany and Ireland for greener American pastures? Or the black men and women from Mom's, who'd been dragged across the ocean in chains and worked to death in Alabama cotton fields? To be fair, Geneva made a point of telling me things got a lot more complicated after people from different areas started intermarrying. But anti-miscegenation laws in Oklahoma made it illegal for blacks to marry whites all the way up to 1967, which meant there were a lot fewer mixed-race kids in the 1920s than there are now. Skull morphology is getting less and less distinct, she'd said. But the person in your back house died around 1921, and to me, his skull features indicate that he was black. I stayed in the shower until my fingers pruned and my skin felt raw, trying to sort out how I felt. In the end, I gave up and decided Geneva could believe whatever she wanted to, black or white. The man buried in our back house had been smashed in the back of the head with a brick. Knowing he was black might help James and me figure out who he was. But in the end, murder was murder. No matter what his skin color, the dead man deserved to have his killer found. He deserved justice. It turned out, Mom was actually kind of proud when I told her about the clinic. "I'm on Jackson's board of directors," she said, "and Marguerite Woods and I graduated from Booker T together." She was tearing lettuce for a salad. Dad was grilling steaks on the back porch. "You know who it was named for?" she asked. I didn't. A.C. Jackson. He was one of the best surgeons in the country, black or white. At least he was, until white men shot him down in his own front yard during the riot. He came out of the house when they ordered him to, unarmed, hands in the air, and they shot him dead. "Just because he was black? Or because he was a doctor?" I asked. She wiped her hands on the Mother's Day apron I'd finger-painted for her in first grade. "No one knows if they singled him out, or if they even knew who he was. No one knows anything for sure about the riot, except that Greenwood burned to ashes." She traced the outline of a thumbprint flower. "Even though your great-great-uncle on my side disappeared that night, my mother didn't hear about him or the riot until she was in her 40s. Mom never talked about her family. I wanted her to keep going, but she stopped and asked me to get carrots from the fridge. She took a sip of wine and started breaking down a yellow pepper. Her knife pattered quick and hard against the cutting board. Mom? Nothing. Why? The knife stopped. Why don't we know more about that night? Or why didn't your grandmother hear about it for so long? Both. She started chopping again. Slowly, with movements as tight and precise as her voice. I don't know, she said. Mom always had answers, especially to the hard questions. I didn't like how carefully she measured her words, or how she kept looking at the neat pile of pepper slices instead of me. I wanted her to pull her shoulders back, lift her chin, and force everything to make sense. I don't need a perfect answer, I said. She finished the pepper and leaned her hips against the sink. It's history, Ro. The messy kind, where truth gets stretched out over thousands of unwritten stories. We don't know how many people died, or even if we should call it a race riot. Riot is convenient, and it's what most people use, but it isn't right. I leaned onto my elbows. Why? Because when people hear the word riot, white people, I mean, they picture black people running crazy in the streets, looting stores and homes and burning things. That wasn't what happened in Greenwood. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying black folks weren't angry or that none of them fought back. But it was white folks who rioted that night. They looted Greenwood, then burned it to the ground. Mom's voice stayed even, but she was squeezing the knife handle so hard the tendons stood out on the backs of her hands. And the vein in her neck, the one I've always used to tell how much trouble I was in, looked ready to burst. "What's the right word?" I asked. Before she could answer, Dad came inside with a platter of grilled zucchini. 5 minutes on the stakes, he said, giving Mom and me this look like he knew exactly what he'd walked in on. He squeezed my shoulder, smiled at Mom, and went back outside. Mom started on the cucumber. "I don't know what the right word is," she said. "Some people say massacre. But to me, that implies wholesale slaughter. It wasn't like that. Plenty of folks lived and had to rebuild their lives from scratch." She stopped cutting and stared down at the board. "Greenwood burned because white folks, not all of them, mind you, but plenty, wanted to clear the bad niggers out of Tulsa. To them, that meant any black man, woman, or child with the audacity to believe they deserved as much dignity and respect as a white person. Only those white folks failed. Because in the end, the survivors went right back and rebuilt what had been theirs from the start." I'd never heard my mother use the N-word. It made my lungs feel too small. She saw, and her face softened. "Your father and I have done our best to make things easier for you," she said. "And maybe that was a mistake. But we wanted you to fill up on good things before you had to face the bad." I tried to tell her I wasn't as naive as she thought, that I knew what code words like thug and uppity and urban really meant, and that I saw the look some people gave me when they thought I wasn't watching. Mom closed her eyes and shook her head slowly. "I know," she said. "I do. But there's so much you haven't learned yet, Rowan. And as much as I wish I could protect you forever, I can't. So I'm glad you're working at the Jackson Clinic and asking questions. It's time." Dad whistled outside, making as much noise as he could, getting the lid on the grill and closing the grate to shut the fire down. Mom glanced toward the racket and smiled. "There are things your father will never understand the way you and I do. Things he can't understand. But he tries. And I love him. I love you, too. So very much." She smiled, and the strength I needed was there. Deeper, even, as if the roots she used to anchor our family had spread wider and sunk further as we talked. "You're growing up so fast," she said. "And that's how it should be. Just please know this." I leaned closer, wishing the counter wasn't between us. "The lives that ended that night mattered. It was a mistake for this city to try to forget, and it's an even bigger one to pretend everything's fine now. Black men and women are dying today for the same reasons they did in 1921. And we have to call that out, Rowan. Every single time." Part 2. You have to make your peace with the chaos, but you cannot lie. Ta-Nehisi Coates.
William, I wasn't in Tulsa the day Sarah Page screamed. It being Memorial Day Monday, Pop didn't open the shop. He was relaxed at breakfast that morning, saying how he might start teaching me how to keep accounts when school let out. "I've seen worse instincts than yours when it comes to customers," he said. "We might as well let that stubborn head of yours have a go at managing sums." Mama smiled over her biscuits and gravy, and I basked in the lukewarm glow of Pop's praise, trying not to dwell on the fact that my tenure at the shop would apparently continue through the summer. After that, the three of us drove by the new house to check on its progress. The workers had installed windows in the main building and put red tile roofs on it and the quarters both. And that made Mama and Pop so happy that our long drive up to Pawhuska was actually pleasant. First thing we did when we got to town was lay flowers on the graves of Mama's mother and brother. Then we headed off to visit Mama's cousins, Margaret and Mary, who lived next door to each other on a street of grand houses built with Osage oil money. They had 6 children between them, and every single one made me push them about in their pedal cars. It was a good day. The kind that made you remember there's more to the world than just the town you live in. I didn't hear about Sarah Page the next morning, either. For Pop carried his newspaper with him into the parlor while he and Mama engaged in early morning negotiations over whether or not I could attend the junior-senior powwow. Pop considered school festivals a frivolous waste of time and felt I should spend my day off of school working at the shop. Mama was of a different mind, and in the end she came out of the parlor with a shine in her eye that told me who'd won. She gave me $15, too, which was a princely enough sum, and said I should get to work half an hour early. I promised quick, then sprinted up Boston Avenue to catch the dime trolley to Sand Springs with the rest of my classmates. Only there was no sign of Cleet. Not then. Not for half an hour after we arrived at the park. That's when he pulled up in his daddy's Cadillac, Eunice at his side. Right out of the gate, he spent a stack of dimes trying to win her a teddy bear at the ring toss. I figure he just about bankrupted himself winning that thing. Afterwards, she fussed and cooed and pretended to feed it boiled peanuts, looking so much like a normal girl that you'd never guess her secret. And Cleet, he made a great show of ignoring me, parading around like a cock of the walk, so that I got fed up with the spectacle of it and caught the first train back after lunch. It was better that way. Seeing how sore tempted I was to tell all our classmates it wasn't just the teddy bear Cleet had paid too much for. Besides, it was Tuesday, Ruby Day, and since Joseph had paid all but the $2.50 finance fee on the Victrola and was set to receive it Friday evening, I was worried her visit that afternoon might be her last. So it wasn't until I stepped off the train at Tulsa that I first heard a paperboy on the platform hollering, "Negro attacks white woman, read all about it!" Which worried me all the way to the shop. I knew, of course, that he couldn't have been talking about Clarence and Addie, for the two-knock incident was old news. Besides, Clarence's death hadn't warranted so much as a mention when it occurred. But the newsies' cry knotted up my mind nonetheless, distracting me so bad that I didn't notice Vernon Fish standing just inside the shop door until I'd near run over him. He was in rare form, waving a copy of the Tribune about, thundering on with fire and brimstone in his voice. "Hanging's too good for criminals like that Rolling boy, and me and the fellas are gonna fix him good. Wanna be a part of it, half-breed?" Then a look evil as any I'd seen came into his eyes, and his hand petted Maybell's grip in his holster. "Gonna neuter him first. Let him dance a while over a bonfire. Mark my words, we'll make that boy beg us for the noose." My innards shriveled as he spoke. I thought how Ruby was likely on her way to visit. And though I'd always been irregular in my prayers, I set about asking God right then and there to keep that little girl safe. Maybe it was the sight of me standing mute, or maybe it was just manners. But Pop got me out of Vernon's crosshairs by saying, "Why don't you fetch Mr. Fish a stool from the back, William?" I practically sprinted to the storeroom. "Ruby," I whispered once the door closed behind me, "you here?" When no response came, I pushed open the alley door and said her name again. After that, I checked to make sure neither Pop nor Vernon had followed me back, and when I was certain they hadn't, said in the loudest whisper I dared, "Go home, Ruby. It's not safe here." And I went inside, locked the door behind me, and made ready to face Vernon Fish. "Everything you need to know is right here, half-breed. Read it for yourself." Vernon jabbed his finger into the bottom right corner of the Tribune and smacked it down on the counter in front of me.
"Nab Negro for attacking girl in an elevator. A Negro delivery boy who gave his name to the public as Diamond Dick, but who has been identified as Dick Rowland, was arrested on South Greenwood Avenue this morning by Officers Carmichael and Pack, charged with attempting to assault the 17-year-old white elevator girl in the Drexel building early yesterday. He will be tried in municipal court this afternoon on a state charge. The girl said she noticed the Negro a few minutes before the attempted assault looking up and down the hallway on the third floor of the Drexel building, as if to see if there was anyone in sight, but thought nothing of it at the time. A few minutes later, he entered the elevator, she claimed, and attacked her, scratching her hands and face and tearing her clothes. Her screams brought a clerk from Renberg's store to her assistance, and the Negro fled. He was captured and identified this morning, both by the girl and the clerk, police say. Tenants of the Drexel building said the girl is an orphan who works as an elevator operator to pay her way through business college.
It didn't sound good, I'll admit. But Pop surprised me, saying, "I know that boy, he doesn't seem the type." Which set Vernon to sputtering how there was no such thing as a trustworthy Negro, and who was Pop to question the paper? Pop said, "I'm not saying it isn't true, Vernon. It just surprises me. That boy shined my shoes on more than one occasion and seemed the quiet type. Did a fine job, too. And I never once heard anyone call him Diamond Dick." "Well, then you're a bigger fool than I thought," Vernon said. Flecks of spittle had gathered at the corners of his mouth. "Most of them know enough to hide their true nature, but all you have to do is look in their eyes to see it. They'll smile and nod, scheming all the while to take our women and everything we got. The only good nigger's a dead nigger, Stanley. And me and my boys are gonna make sure Dick Rowland's good as gold before the night's through." Pop cleared his throat and pushed the paper back across the counter. Vernon swiped it up and stuffed it under his arm, said, "I'm meeting up with the boys to discuss the situation. You coming?" He waited, standing so still I could hear the breath coming and going from all three of us. Just about killed me, that quiet. Till finally Pop smoothed his mustache with his fingertips, saying, "Not just now, Vernon. Can't leave William here alone." Vernon's lips parted, but his teeth stayed clenched. "Close the damned shop and bring him," he said. Pop shook his head and said he couldn't do that. Vernon's face flushed deep red. His lips went white. "You know, Stanley," he said, getting up to leave, "the surest way to protect your business is to come with us and clear that nest of savages out of Greenwood. If you don't, they'll be coming for everything you've got." That notion seemed to unsettle Pop, but he held his ground all the same. Vernon stuck his smoldering cigar between his teeth and said, in a voice full of ash and gravel, "At least your son had spine enough to stand up to that boy in the speakeasy. Must be he gets it from your squaw." Then Vernon walked out. Pop came from behind the counter, fists clenched so tight it looked as if his knuckle bones might pop through the skin. And he stared out the window, looking up and down a street quiet as a cemetery at dawn. "They won't be taking anything. Not with 10 wives for every Negro in Greenwood," he said, so soft that I couldn't tell if I should respond or keep hushed. I coughed into my hand. Pop gave a start like he'd forgotten I was there. "Don't you have work to do?" he snapped. And I yes-sired him and hopped too, making for the storeroom as fast as I could, grateful for once that my mop and bucket awaited. Soon as I got to the storeroom, I opened the back door wide, propped it open with a brick, and started sweeping. It was usually the part of the job I went slowest at, there being no ammonia involved. But that afternoon, I felt like a mechanical toy wound too tight, pushing dust ahead of me in short, choppy thrusts. The physical movement was soothing, though. Enough that I swept the whole place twice, and still there was no sign of Ruby. So I sloshed out a measure of ammonia and filled the rest of the bucket with water from the spigot out back. My eyes went bleary and my lungs squeezed tight as I mopped. But that was nothing compared to the way the hate in Vernon's words chewed at my insides. I mopped the hell out of that floor, let me tell you, sweating and thinking about Clarence Banks and how even if Dick Rowland had done wrong by that girl in the elevator, a judge should decide his fate, not a lynch mob of Vernon fishes. Long after there was no dirt left to scrub, I went out back and squatted down to rinse the bucket at the spigot. Cool water spilled over my arms. I cut my palms and splashed them over my head, closing my eyes against the drips. "You baptizing yourself, Will Tillman?" Ruby giggled. It surprised me so bad that I tipped backwards onto the ground. and my heart lightened at the sight of her, then went heavy as lead when I remembered our circumstances. I put my finger to my lips to shush her and fumbled about, trying to stand. Ruby giggled harder. "I mean it," I said. "Something bad's happening and you need to get home quick." Her giggle quieted. "I know," she said. Pop's voice came through the storeroom door, then Vernon's. It made me sick in my stomach knowing he'd returned. Both of them were close, like they could come through the back room door any minute. "Go home, Ruby," I pleaded. "There's a crazy man up front, and you don't know what he'd do if he caught you." And she looked into me with her deep brown eyes and said, "Of course I do, Will. Same thing they're gonna try and do to that man in the jailhouse." Which made me feel sick all over again as I realized that Ruby knew better than me what was going on. She always had. The storeroom doorknob turned. Pop and Vernon were coming. "Get out of here," I all but begged. Ruby frowned, serious like her brother, then let loose the hellion's grin I'd come to love so well. "Ain't nobody gonna catch me, Will," she whispered. Then Pop and Vernon were in the storeroom. And Ruby was gone. We ate an early supper that night, for Pop had decided to join the crowd gathering in front of the courthouse. He ate fast, gulping down his pie and coffee before Mama and me finished our trout. "Eat your meal," Pop said, and he wiped his mouth off, adding, "And remember what I told you." Mama cleared her throat. "Will's a good boy," she said. "I only wish you'd reconsider and stay home with us." But Pop said he was obligated to go see what was what downtown. After all, the last sheriff had let a band of vigilantes walk out of the jailhouse with a murder suspect in their possession. They'd driven him out to the country and lynched him, Pop reminded us, and he'd been white. Besides, there were rumors aplenty that armed Negroes up in Little Africa were gathering in the streets, planning God knew what. And such a thing could not stand. Only from what I'd heard, Tulsa's new sheriff was tough as nails and twice as sharp, making it unlikely he'd require the assistance of a shopkeep like my father. But Pop had made up his mind to go, and there was no persuading him otherwise. After Pop left, Angelina cleared the table and Mama asked me to accompany her into the parlor to help wind yarn. All year long, she made caps for poor babies and orphans. Pop used to complain about the cost of it every time Mama pulled out her needles, and one evening a few months prior, he said something to the effect that it wasn't up to him to put a hat on the head of every squalling ragamuffin in Tulsa. That time Mama's eyes never lifted and her hands never slowed in their work as she responded, "I'm quite certain it's not, Stanley, which is why the yarn money comes from my own income, same as the payments we're making on that fine new house you wanted." That ended Pop's complaints right then and there, and showed me a side of my mother I rarely saw. For though she was the stoic sort, her words had bite and heft when she wanted them to. "Quit fidgeting," she said in the parlor. I was perched on her footstool, hands caught up in the length of soft blue yarn she was winding into a ball. I mumbled I was sorry. Mama smiled. And that was all that passed between us as she wound one skein of yarn and another. Finally, on the third, she asked would I like a cup of tea. Jittery as I was over the events of the day, I said I would. Mama called Angelina in and asked her to fetch us each a cup. And when Angelina set the china service down on the side table, Mama asked was her son's family still living up in the Negro Quarter. Now, Angelina may have been getting on in years, but there was always a hum about her, an energy. That night, though, it was quiet. "Yes'm," she whispered. "How many are there?" Mama asked. 5, Angelina replied. "Samuel, his wife, and the 3 boys." Mama pondered that, then said, "I've been thinking about the violence in Chicago a few years back. How a riot broke out after those white men threw stones at that poor Negro boy in the lake until he drowned. Have you room enough in your quarters to invite your kin down for the night?" Angelina brightened, then faded all over again. "Might be, Miss Catherine, but they haven't a telephone." Mama dropped a half-wound ball of yarn into her skirt, picked up her cup and saucer, and took two ladylike sips. The china barely clinked when she set it down. She motioned for me to give her the looped yarn, saying, "I'll take that, William."
"Angelina, would you be so kind as to ride along with William and show him where your family lives?"
That put the starch back in Angelina's collar, and quick. But me? Well, my jaw dropped so fast and so low, I near had to scrape it off the floor. Then Mama reached into her pocket and pulled out the truck key and gave it to me, saying, "I trust your father's driving lesson was sufficient to get you safely to Greenwood and back?" I nodded yes, even though it wasn't true. "Good," Mama said. She took 5 crisp new $10 bills from her knitting bag. "For emergencies," she said, handing them to me. "Be back by sundown." The whistle from the Midland Valley Express came loud through the open parlor window. Mama set to winding the yarn herself. Angelina made for the truck. And me? I did exactly as Mama had bid.
Rowan. James and I started going to Kane's ballroom together right after we met. A real estate tycoon, some founding father of Tulsa type who dabbled in politics and the KKK, built it as a garage for his car collection in the 20s. After that, another someone bought the place and turned it into a dance hall. Today, it's where you go for concerts. They usually don't get anybody huge. Big names go to the BOK Center downtown and charge more than mere mortals can afford. But Kane's is cheap, fun, and gets great bands on their way up. The catch is, there's no seating. It's just this big dance floor with a few 3-step bleachers against the side walls. If you want to get close to the stage, you line up a few hours before the show, rush to the front of the dance floor when they open the doors, and park yourself in the best spot you can get. And if anyone tries to push past you, it's perfectly acceptable to throw an elbow. James and I don't bother with that. We show up just before the opening band set and watch from the back. The view's still great, no one vapes in your face, and you can pee whenever you want without losing your spot. The barbecue place next door does decent sweet potato fries, too. And when it comes to the actual bands, James and I figured out through trial and error that the ones with the lamest-sounding names usually put on the best shows. "They suck," James said. He picked me up late, just like always, and parking had been bad. So the band opening for Roy Boy and his Kentucky Kickers was maybe halfway done by the time we got our fries and squeezed in next to a bedenimed older couple on the bleachers. I didn't think the band was that bad, but I was way more focused on all the things I wanted to tell James than I was on the music. After our fries, though, and after the band finished its set, so I didn't have to scream over them. But James had things to tell me, too, and he didn't want to wait. "Polk, find the rectory and shop" were all I could make out when he shouted in my ear. "What?" I shouted back. He gave me his phone. "Polk, find the rectory" was actually the Polk Fine Directory, a printed list of businesses and people in Tulsa from 1921 that someone had scanned and put online. James reached over and scrolled down to show me an advertisement for the Victory Victrola shop. "Our prices will be music to your ears, Victrolas and phonograph records, conveniently located on Main Street." He scrolled some more and pointed to one of the actual listings. "Tillman Stanley G, parentheses Catherine, prop Victory Victrola shop, Main Street, R1301 South Norfolk Avenue." "You're a god!" I shouted. The woman next to us shot me an ugly look. James pointed to the entry beneath it. "Tillman, William E., student, R1301 South Norfolk Avenue." At first, I didn't get it. But then James pointed to the W in William and the T in Tillman. WT, the initials on the Victory Victrola shop receipt. It looked like William, the student, was Stanley Tillman's son. The song ended and the singer started talking about their T-shirts and CDs. Impressive, I told James. What else you got? You mean I haven't given you enough already, sweetness? James said, which I thought was weird until I noticed he was discreetly pointing at the denim couple. They were side-eyeing us, disapproval practically oozing out of their pores. I scooted closer, put my lips to his ear, and whispered, "The anthropologist found a tooth in the dirt that wasn't from the skeleton." He giggled like I'd used my tongue for more than talking. After the band finished their last song, James patted his lap and I climbed onto it. He winced, muttering something about his legs being sore from working out that morning, and the denim couple started quietly shitting kittens. Then the roadies came out to set up Roy Boy and his Kentucky Kickers gear, and I told James everything Geneva had said about the skeleton. Racist much? He grumbled when I got to the part about her using the skull to decide the skeleton's race. Denim Man cleared his throat and said something to his wife. All we heard was trashy and typical. I wrapped my arms around James's neck saying, maybe, but Geneva kept saying how even though race might be an artificially created construct, patterns of evolutionary differences in skeletal morphologies from isolated geographic areas are measurable and real. James's eyebrow went up. What? I think she was trying to say it's complicated and that she's not a racist. He brushed my hair away from my ear and whispered, "Speaking of racists, shall we?" I pointed to the over 21 wristband he'd gotten with his lousy fake ID at the door. "Only if you buy me a beer." James smiled, stood up, took my hand, and planted a big wet kiss on it. Then he turned to the denims, flashed them my most favorite of his wicked grins, and said, "Don't worry, folks, it's not serious. I'm just their baby daddy." And then we walked away, leaving them to sputter and grumble over the sorry state of Negro youth in America today. I didn't get home from the concert until after 1, so I skipped my run the next morning and slept late. There was a sticky note on the fridge when I got up saying Dad was at the office and Mom had gone to the gym. I showered, threw on a t-shirt and basketball shorts, and pulled up directions to the title company. Dad had kept his word and called them, and since I hadn't been able to get there during the week, Saturday before noon was my big chance. It was a nice morning. Not too hot, not too sunny. I stopped for a chai at the coffee shop James thought was pretentious, the one next to the barbecue place where people line up for ribs an hour before it opens. Gray clouds hung low around the Art Deco spire of Boston Avenue Methodist. Semis on the broken Arrow Expressway made the overpass vibrate under my tires. Half a block past that, I clipped the edge of a pothole hard enough to send hot chai splattering down the inside of my thigh. I cursed and set the cup down quick. Then I saw the cat, frozen in the middle of the road, staring at my car with its tail tucked and its hind legs sunk low. I hit the brakes, slammed forward and back as the seatbelt locked. There was no thump, no yowl. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw it bolt unhurt toward the sidewalk. Relief and adrenaline jacked through me all at once. Then I was rocketing forward again, so hard that white, hot pain sang through my ribs as they hit the seatbelt again. My chin jammed down into my chest before the back of my head whipped slingshot fast into the headrest behind me. The world went black. And when the light came back, everything was slow, blurry, quiet. Then a man's voice was trampling my ears. It was muffled, but loud and angry enough to make my eyelids flutter open against light that seemed too bright to be real.
"What the hell?
The hell are you doing stopping in the middle of the street?" I rolled my head toward my window. The man was waving his arms, cell phone in one hand, running his words together so fast I couldn't make sense of them. A knob of pain pulsed at the bottom of my skull. The man opened the door and snapped his fingers in front of my face, his cheeks pale with anger. "Hey! Don't pretend you can't hear me! I'm sick of people acting like..." Wisps of pain wrapped around each syllable in my head. He kept shouting, on and on and on. The chrome grille of his massive pickup was in my rearview mirror. So was the second figure coming toward us. Grizzled, black, and dressed in a dirty shirt and fatigues three sizes too big. I knew him. Arvin. "Hey, you're my girly friend from Jackson," he said, peeking around the truck's driver. The black and gray stubble on his chin reminded me of my grandfather's funeral, of the smell of candles and gardenias. "Back off, buddy," the driver barked. "Go back to the gutter you crawled out of." Arvin ignored him and tried to get closer to me. "Gotta get you to Dr. Woods, young lady," he mumbled in his raspy voice. "She'll make you all better." "Arvin," my voice floated in the air like a ghost. "I said back off," the driver shouted. And when Arvin didn't, the man put both hands against his chest and shoved. "Goddamn nigger." That time his words were calm, deliberate, cruel. Arvin's arms flew up. He pedaled backwards, tripping and stumbling into the second traffic lane behind him on the one-way street. Then there was a horrible crunching thud, and Arvin's body flew up and over the hood of an old gray Suburban. The back of his head hit the street. The Suburban lurched to a stop. The woman inside was screaming. Arvin didn't move. Sirens wailed louder and louder, ping-ponging around in my 1,000-pound head as flashing red and blue lights filled my mirrors. The siren stopped. The wisps turned into angry fingers of pain squeezing the sides of my head. Then a policeman was coming toward us. The truck's driver watched Arvin's body like he expected it to stand up and come at him. He didn't need to worry. Arvin wasn't ever going to stand up again.
William, our trip to Greenwood was touch and go at first. It took me 3 tries to back the truck out of the driveway, 2 to start forward. And every time I managed to gather a little steam, a stop sign would show up and throw a wrench into the works. Angelina sat behind me in the truck's cargo space, out of sight, and holding on for dear life as we jerked along. It was for her sake as much as my own that I started ignoring the stop signs altogether. The sun was only just starting to drop at that point, meaning sunset was still a ways away. But there was a quietness to the streets I didn't like. People were about, to be sure. Men, mostly, headed in the direction of the courthouse. A few children played in yards, too, and every now and again we'd pass a woman sitting on her front porch, snapping beans or darning socks. Even so, the air had a hushed feel to it, like the city was holding its breath. It was a different story altogether in Greenwood. As soon as I headed north off of Archer, the tension in the air got thick enough to chew. Shopkeepers and clerks stood in doorways, men huddled in groups of 3s and 4s, talking. Until they caught sight of me, that is. Then everything stilled as their wary gazes followed our progress up the street. After Angelina realized where we were and came up to sit beside me, those gazes turned curious. More than anything else, I wanted to find Angelina's family quick so we could turn around and go home. For though the truck was unmarked, the white of my skin made us stand out bright as a signal fire. As soon as the Dreamland Theater marquee came into sight, though, I knew things wouldn't go easy. There were cars on the street in front of it, and more black men than I'd ever seen assembled in one place. Enough so I hadn't room enough in the street to pass. It felt like 1,000 faces were staring at me as the truck lurched to a stop. Looking back, I reckon there were fewer than 100. But fear makes everything bigger and worse. It didn't help that some of those men held rifles and shotguns. Pistols, too, though many appeared unarmed. And I'm not ashamed to say that the sight set my hands to shaking, especially when a man tall as a chimney and dark as soot came to my window. "You oughtn't be here," he said. Then Angelina spoke up with an authority I'd never heard in her voice before, saying, "You let us through now. We come to fetch my boy and his family, and you got no business stopping us." The man didn't back off one bit, only asked her who her boy was, Samuel Brightwater, she replied, after which the man turned and pointed, saying, "You mean that Samuel Brightwater over there?" Then Angelina was out of the truck and marching into the crowd, parting it like Moses did the Red Sea. I wish I knew what words passed between her and her son, and that I could say he joined us in the truck. Only I don't, and I can't. For after a conversation that seemed to go on forever, Angelina returned, alone, and got in without looking back. "You want to take your next left, Mr. William," she said. I asked, "Was he coming?" Angelina motioned with her chin towards the opening in the crowd in front of us and said, "He's got plans of his own. Best be on our way." And you know, that was the first time I ever managed all the levers and pedals just right, so that we started up Greenwood without so much as a sputter. Other than offering a word here and there to guide our progress, Angelina kept quiet until we stopped at the curb in front of her son's house. It was small, with an outhouse in the back and a yard full of dirt and bull nettles. The porch was swept clean, though, and the little boy who ran out onto the front stoop to greet us had creases ironed into the sleeves of his shirt. "I'll just be a minute," Angelina said. Then she left me alone in the truck, pretending there weren't eyes watching me from behind every curtain window on the block. True to her word, Angelina came back out quick with the boy from the porch plus two more. All three wore caps and faded overalls and each carried a sack over his shoulder. The older two looked worried and angry all at once. The littlest one was bawling. "Get in," Angelina told them when they got to the truck. They did as she said, sitting on the floorboards. The youngest sniffled and hiccuped, and Angelina said, "Hush now, Freddy," and shut the back door. I asked what was wrong. "Doesn't want to leave his dog," she replied, through the passenger side, pointing to a scruffy brown mutt straining against its chain to peek around the back corner of the unpainted shack. The little boy snuffled. "That's enough," Angelina snapped. The boy did his best to be still, and though Pop had never let me have a dog of my own, I was about to say how Freddy should fetch the thing and bring it with him. Only before I could, Angelina marched back, unlatched the chain, patted the dog's head, and left it standing there with its ears perked high. "Dog can take care of herself," she muttered when she got back. Then she motioned for Freddy to come closer. She wiped his cheeks and nose with her apron, kissed his forehead, told him that was the end of the matter. Only it wasn't. For as soon as Angelina returned to the house, the boy started crying all over again. "Shush," the oldest one said. "Lulu will be fine." And Freddy came back at him angry, saying, "You don't know that, Sam. You don't know nothing." I turned around just in time to see the littlest boy's heel come down hard on the top of Sam's foot. It must have hurt, too, for Sam winced. But he held his tongue and didn't kick back. "I'm Will," I said, hoping the interruption would settle things down. "Samuel Jr.," the eldest replied. "This is Marcus, and that's Freddy. Where are you taking us?" "To my house," I replied, which made him knit his brow and ask, "Why?" I had no good answer for that. I knew bad things were brewing. I knew there was a Negro man at the courthouse who some white folks wanted dead. I knew there were Negroes gathering outside the Dreamland, too. And more than anything, I knew I was half out of my mind with worry over Ruby. But that's not what I told Sam. To him I said, "In case something bad happens, I suppose." Which made his forehead pinch even tighter. "That's not what I mean," he said. "I mean, why are you taking us to your house?" "Because my mama told me to," I replied, for that was the honest-to-God truth of the matter. And it must have made sense enough to Sam, for he leaned his back against the side of the truck and kept quiet. Then it occurred to me that maybe I should ask him if he knew what was going on in front of the Dreamland. Sam nodded when I did. "Well, then what?" I asked. And he told me how folks were worried that white men were gonna lynch Dick Rowland before he was tried in court, and that the people gathered at the Dreamland, his pa included, were trying to decide what to do about it. "Some of them believe it'd be best to send an important man like Mr. Gurley down to talk to the sheriff," he said.
If it weren't for Mr. Gurley, there'd be no such place as Greenwood at all. But there's others who think things have gone too far for talk. I asked him which side of that debate his father was on. Sam shrugged and said his pa didn't figure any man deserved to die until God, or at least a judge, decided he should, no matter what the color of his skin. Then the Brightwater front door slammed shut, and a short, slight woman locked it up. She and Angelina came to the truck together, carrying a heavy-looking sack between them. "Mr. William, this is my daughter-in-law, Grace," Angelina said. I tipped my cap to her and hopped out to hoist the sack into the truck. Grace looked surprised. Then her lips trembled and she thanked me, which made my cheeks turn hot. After that, Angelina climbed in and told me to drive due west, as that was the quickest way out of Greenwood. And it seemed such a fine idea that I was clear to Cincinnati Avenue before I recognized the opportunity I was wasting. Stopped the truck, put it in idle, and faced my passengers. "Any of you folks know Joseph or Ruby Goodhope?" I asked. 5 worried sets of eyes peered back at me. 3 heads shook no. But the middle boy, Marcus, grimaced and reached up to the inside of his arm like it pained him. "Do you know them?" I asked him direct. And he squinched his lips up tight and nodded a little and said, "Don't know Joseph, but I know her." "You know where she lives?" I asked. Marcus shook his head, but Freddy sniffled and wiped his nose on the back of his sleeve, saying, "He's lying." Marcus scowled, and Grace looked at him stern and told him he'd best tell the truth. Marcus hung his head and hunkered down further. "Yeah, I know where she lives," he said. "Only I don't want to go there." Then Grace turned stony like only a mother can, and Marcus shrank even smaller. "I'll show you," he said. So I turned the truck around, stalling once, and steered back toward the heart of Greenwood. And over the engine's putter, I heard Marcus grumble to anyone who cared to listen, "I can't stand that Ruby Goodhope. She pinches." In the end, Marcus never did get pinched. Leastways, not that night. For the only person we found at Ruby and Joseph's house was their mother, distraught over her 2 missing children and scared near to death by the sight of a 6-foot white boy standing on her front porch. Angelina smoothed things over. She introduced herself and asked the woman's name, which was Della. Then she told Della how I knew Joseph from him making deliveries to my father's store, and Ruby because she tagged along. She didn't know to say anything about the Victrola, for that was a surprise I wasn't about to ruin. Then Angelina said my mama was a kind soul willing to open her home to Negro women and children until the trouble down at the courthouse blew over. Looking at Ruby and Joseph's mother, so scared and worn in her faded blue dress, I knew I had to invite her along. But after I'd done it, she looked as if the idea made her sick at her stomach. "Thank you kindly," she said. "But I'll just wait here until my babies come home." Then she forced a smile for my sake and cast a worried look up and down the street. And Angelina patted her arm and told her we'd be praying her children got home soon. "Best be going now, Mr. Will," she said after that, nudging me towards the street. "Sun's almost down, and your own mama will be worrying." I didn't want to leave until I'd found Ruby, but I drove straight home anyway. And Mama had been worrying. I could tell by the nervous chirp in her voice when she met us in the driveway. "Back the truck up to Angelina's door, William," she said, loud enough for every wag-tongued busybody in the neighborhood to hear. "I don't want you dropping that mattress in the dirt." Which I understood straight off was her way of telling me we couldn't let anyone catch sight of Angelina's family, so we should pretend we were unloading a mattress into her quarters. And though I made a hash of the job, stopping and starting and stalling and cursing under my breath, I eventually got the truck's back end close enough for Grace and her family to scoot inside without being seen. After that, Mama had me park the truck where it belonged. Then the 2 of us went into the main house, and Mama wrapped a plate of sandwiches inside clean bed linens and told me to carry them out to Grace and Sam and Marcus and Freddy, who I found cramped and sweating but grateful nonetheless. While they ate, Angelina came back into the big house with me and fetched a glass of lemonade with mint in it for Mama. and Mama said it was dark enough then for Angelina to take a whole pitcher of the stuff back to her guests. As for me, I was too full of nerves and worry to stay inside. So I took my ragged school copy of Macbeth out onto the front porch and set about trying to make myself read.